Thank you. That's the beautiful thing about IONS, is it's an open forum. It is a pleasure and an honor to stand in front of you tonight. I'm a near-death experiencer myself. My name is Jeffrey Olson. I was introduced to IONS, and I found it a safe place to share and to listen and to learn and to contemplate from a very neutral standpoint. In today's world of violence and fear and disruption, Dr. Moody brings a message of hope. The interesting thing about Dr. Moody is he doesn't come from a religious perspective. He's a doctor of philosophy and also an MD, so he comes at it from a very clinical standpoint, a very neutral view. He's renowned in this field. He actually coined the phrase near-death experience, or NDE. He's a renowned author of Life After Life and Glimpses in Eternity. And in the brief time I've spent with Dr. Moody, and my experience has been, he's a man of deep spiritual depth and also of integrity. It's my pleasure and my honor to introduce Dr. Raymond Moody. Let's give him a warm welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. And I'm just delighted to be with you. As I'm sure you all know, the basic theme, really what everybody wants to know about near-death experiences, is their potential relationship to the biggest question of existence, which it really is there a life after death? What I'm going to do tonight is three things. First of all, I'm going to talk about near-death experiences in general and to talk a little bit about the knowledge that we have about near-death experiences up to and subsequent to the publication of my book, Life After Life, in 1975, which kind of drew attention to this. And then in the second part of my talk, I want to go on and talk about a closely related and perhaps even identical mode of experience, which I call shared death experiences. The experiences of people who are at the bedside of the dying and who have some sort of extraordinary personal experience. And then, as a sort of 5-minute prognostication at the end, I want to talk a little bit about the road ahead, what the future will bring for the study of near-death experiences and the question of life after death, because inquiry into this field is dynamic. It's still moving forward, and we have a lot to learn. And I want to preface this by saying something very important to me. That is that I think that if you're going to stand before the public and presume on your doctoral degrees to talk about this huge question of the possibility of an afterlife, it has always seemed to me that that brings an enormous burden of responsibility on a scholar, and let me explain why. I should sort of briefly mention to you that my PhD is in philosophy, and that was my initial major in college and so on. I was a philosophy professor for a while, professor of logic and ancient Greek philosophy. Then I went on to medical school and became a psychiatrist. It's always been in my mind, as long as I've been talking about this subject, which is well over 40 years now, that if a person comes before the public and says, makes some positive claim about an afterlife, then, as I said, that brings upon you an enormous burden of responsibility for this reason. From long experience, I know that what draws many people to the question of an afterlife is a loss of a loved one to death. That is a very common reason why people get interested in this sort of thing. And I have been de facto a grief counselor since about 1970. That's one of my major areas of clinical interest, is helping people who are grieving. Now, let's suppose that I, Raymond Moody, or anybody else with a doctoral degree stands before the public and says, oh, that we have evidence of an afterlife and so on. And people who are grieving will take comfort from that, Because in our society, and this strikes me as really strange, people lend extra credence to what somebody says if they have a doctoral degree behind their name. I had two of them myself before I was 31, and I know that there's not much to that. Especially when you're thinking about a question of an afterlife. Well, who is the expert on an afterlife, really? There's no field that has expertise in that. But let's say that I make that remark that we have evidence or positive reason for expecting an afterlife. And people lend credence to that remark because I have degrees, and then they take comfort from that. It gives them comfort in their grief. Now let's flash forward a year or 2 years or several years, and suppose my colleagues or some other scholars found some weakness in my procedures, or that I made mistakes in my procedure so that my conclusion is not warranted. Well, now think about that from the perspective of someone who took comfort from my words. They would, number one, be propelled back into their grief because they had their grief alleviated because of what I said, but now they found it was tacky work and had a mistake in it, so they come back into their grieving process. And also they have a legitimate grievance against me because they could say, well, you said such and such, and now we find that that was mistaken. And the reason I'm saying all this is that I think that it is academic malpractice, in my opinion, for somebody to make some sort of generalization like that. Oh, yes, there's an afterlife based on this and that. Unless they have really, really good ironclad reason for saying it. And that is why, as those of you who might have read my books and so on, you probably remember I say throughout them that we have to be very careful about this, and these are very hard things to figure out. It's not yet scientific. In the year 2011, it is just not yet a scientific question whether there's an afterlife. We don't have scientific methods that could tell us either way. I want to emphasize this because I have reached the point in the last couple of years in which, after all of these years being reluctant to draw a conclusion, I have been, in the past couple of years, almost squeezed into a corner where I've noticed in about the last couple of years that when I try to say some other thing, given all that I know and have observed, when I try to say something other than that this does seem to be an afterlife, I have found myself feeling more like I'm running away or trying to rationalize rather than just to confront what seems to be. So I can begin this by saying that just in the past couple of years I have reached that. It is really now very difficult for me to think my way out of this, to think any other alternative than just to go on and say that this does seem to me to indicate that there's an afterlife. But now I have a lot of explaining to do, so let me go now into these things that I mentioned that I wanted to talk with you about. First, about my initial wave of research on this into near-death experiences, and then to extend it a little bit into the frontier of shared death experiences, which are the identical phenomenon having all of the elements that we know of as a near-death experience, except that they occur not to people who almost die and return, but rather to bystanders at the bedside of someone who dies. Why is this distinction significant? Well, if you think about it for a moment, it totally undermines the so-called skeptical objection to near-death experiences. I'm sure you've all heard this, people say this, that, oh yes, well, these near-death experiences, what that is somebody has a cardiac arrest or whatever, it impedes the blood flow to the brain, and the brain becomes relatively oxygen-deprived, and that throws up this hallucinatory phenomenon, which is interpreted as a near-death experience. And I'm sure you've all heard that objection. But you see, the trouble is that the bystanders at the bedside who are not ill or injured have identically the same phenomenon. So they're not ill or injured. That obviously doesn't apply to them, and yet it's one and the same experience. This, I think, is a significant new development, so I'll go on and talk about that. And then, as I said, the last couple of minutes, I want to talk about where I see this headed. Whatever anybody's opinion is, however anybody would like it to be, the reality is that we are now on the verge of genuine rational progress toward the rational comprehension of this question of an afterlife. I will talk a little bit then at the end about where I see the future of this kind of inquiry headed. Now, as to how I got interested in this, I was a philosophy major, as I mentioned, and Plato has been my favorite philosopher overall since I first went to college in 1962. And at the end of Plato's Republic, there is the story about a warrior named who was believed dead on the battlefield and then spontaneously revived at his funeral. And Plato tells this story in a very, very solemn way, in a way that indicates that Plato took this very seriously. He was convinced that this man had actually been to the other world beyond death. And that impressed me. I had not really thought about the question of life after death as a young person. I was an amateur astronomer from the age of 7. My dad was not religious. He had been in World War II. He was a surgeon and a professional military officer and a medic in the Pacific Theater in World War II. And he never talked about this much because, you know, that's how that generation were. They just didn't talk about things. I can only imagine, as I've reached more or less maturity, what the horrors that my dad might have been through. You know, we just were not a religious family. And my first inkling of this notion of an afterlife, as I said, literally came with reading Plato in 1962 at University of Virginia when I was a first-year student. And then, 3 years later, one of my philosophy professors mentioned to us that right there in Charlottesville at the medical school was Dr. George Ritchie, who was a professor of psychiatry, and that some years before, George had been pronounced dead, was in a state of apparent cardiac arrest for at least 9 minutes, and was revived and had this experience. So naturally, I took the opportunity to listen to Dr. Ritchie's story, as many other students there at the University of Virginia when I was there did. And I can tell you this, that I'm 67 years old now. I was 19 years old then. And I can still say that George Ritchie is the finest human being I ever knew in my life. So this experience that I heard from Dr. Ritchie had a profound impact on me. I went ahead and I got my PhD in philosophy in 1969, became a philosophy professor myself. And again, by some sort of coincidence, actually, a young student came up after class one day and had scars all over his body. He had obviously been injured. And he told me this story that had happened to him about a year before. And that was in 1969. And I am not really, I've studied statistics a little bit, but it's not one of my specialties. But I immediately realized at that point when this young man told me identically what I'd heard from George Ritchie 4 years before, I knew there had to be more of them. Because if you think about it, what are the odds that Raymond Moody, without really seeking it out, would have come across the only two of these there were in a four-year period? So over the next few years that I was a philosophy professor, I heard a dozen or so of these from my students. And then by the time I entered medical school in 1972, I had quite a number of cases. And then obviously being in the medical profession after that gave me a good opportunity to talk with lots and lots of patients who had been to the brink of death and returned. And what I learned, which has held up fairly well, I think, over the years, The initial book I wrote, Life After Life, in 74. And it was based on about 150 cases of people that I had talked with up at that point. And I think that was enough cases to give a pretty good overview of the kinds of elements that belong in a near-death experience. And again, you've all heard this story, I'm sure, many times by now. Basically, it is as we see on TV and in the movies, it's pretty much like that. That's what patients tell us. They say that at this point where their doctor says that they are dead, which they often describe to you, by the way, all the time I hear people say things like, and I heard the doctor say, oh my God, he's dead, or we've lost her, or words to that effect. What is very interesting about that is that I think from the common sense point of view, what most people would think about a situation like that when somebody was dying is that they would be going into a state of obtundation or diminished consciousness, or that their consciousness would be becoming cloudy at that point. And I think that's the common sense attitude, but in reality, that's not what happens. People say things like, I have never felt so alive as when I heard that doctor say, he's dead. And I think, again, if we're just thinking about this abstractly, we might imagine that it's as though a person is going into a dreamlike state. Things become cloudy and so on. But again, that's the exact opposite of what happens. You know, if you're like me, when you wake up in the morning, you're coming out of a dream and you're trying to hold on to those surrealistic images, and everything is kind of incoherent. There's kind of scattered weird images and they don't fit together. And when you wake up, you feel like you're coming back to reality, right? Well, that's exactly what people with near-death experiences say. That when they have this near-death experience, they feel like they're coming back to reality, but that this is the dream state. That what we are in now is dreamlike and incoherent compared to that more ordered and more real state of consciousness they enter into when they get out of their body. People say things like, it was more real than real, or hyper-real. I was thinking about that several years ago. I was in Los Angeles lecturing, and I went to a shopping mall, and trying to find the exit to the mall, I walked by the first high-definition TV set I had ever seen. And when I looked at that screen, my first thought was, you know, those images look more real than real. They really do. It's like you see it in a more real way. And so I was curious about that, and so the next few days, I asked a friend of mine who's an expert in television technology. I said, why is that? Why does the image on the screen of a high-definition set seem more real than real? And he said, it's because the screen contains more information than your mind is able to process, which I thought was very interesting and perhaps apropos to the near-death experience. But that's what people say. That their consciousness becomes heightened, and they look down and they see, typically going on down below them, the events of the resuscitation. People will tell me that they can understand perfectly what is being communicated back and forth between the doctor and the nurses and the other people present. But they typically tell me it's not like an auditory sensation. It's not like you hear a voice, but rather that you become immediately aware of what the doctors or nurses are thinking rather than actually audibly saying. And when they try to respond in turn, they try to ask, how can it be that I'm out of my body up here looking at you down below? It doesn't make any sense. But they realize that the doctor can't hear them. And no one seems to be able to see them. So in that process, it dawns on them that this is what we call death. At that point, events begin to unfold, and people enter into a state of existence or a state of consciousness that however articulate they may be, however many languages they may speak, however well educated they may be, I hear all the time from people the same sort of words. I just can't describe it to you. There are no words. I heard Jeff say that just a couple of nights ago. He used those very words in describing his experience. And that's how it is. It's even very articulate people. Jeff is a writer and does writing and is very good at language, you see, but he says words fail. And so people say that there's no way they can describe it, but as close as they come to it is, they say it's as though you enter into a sort of tunnel or a passageway or a tube, and they feel that they go through this tunnel or passageway and they come out on the other side into an incredibly brilliant light. They tell us that they have to use the word light because maybe that's the closest earthly experience we have to this. And they say it's far brighter than any light that we've ever experienced while we're alive, but that nonetheless, it's not hurtful to your eyes. It's not uncomfortable. As a matter of fact, as you go into that light, you feel complete peace, joy, comfort, and terrific love. People say, as a matter of fact, I say light, I could just as easily say love. In ordinary language, light and love are two different things, but apparently in this other state of existence I'm alluding to here, light and love are the same phenomenon. And in that light, people often tell us that relatives or friends of theirs who have passed away form almost a grieving committee, seem to be there in a way to help them through this transition or passage. But apparently when you see your deceased relatives and friends there in that light, you don't see them as having a physical form, as in this life. People try to articulate this by saying another kind of body or a spirit body, but whatever terminology they use, they say this is very difficult to describe, but that there's a kind of vehicle there, but that the way you know the person that you see is through the heart, through the memories and the feelings and the sense of presence. And then typically as this experience unfolds, one way this is typically described is they say that out of this field of light, it's as though one part of the light takes on its own personal identity. People often say that there is a personal presence there with them, a being of light. I've talked with thousands of people from all over the world, and Christians tend to say Christ, Jews tend to say God, and I've even talked with people from India, China, Japan, and sometimes people don't even put a label on it, but they just say this complete presence of complete compassion and love. And that in connection with that, they say everything else sort of disappears, and they find themselves surrounded by a full-color, three-dimensional, moving, holographic panorama, which in many of the accounts, they will say that literally every single detail of their lives was portrayed there. Sometimes I go after people tell me their story, I go back and I say something like, well, you said that in this panorama you saw every action that you had ever done. Do you mean that literally? And often people say, yes, absolutely. As one man said, including my own birth by cesarean section, he said. Yet in this framework, it's not exactly like living your life or reviewing your life from the way we do it when we're thinking back on our past while we're in this body. But rather, they say that in this panorama, you see yourself as though you were another person. You may see yourself there doing the action. But when the action has its consequence or its sequelae, you are embedded in the consciousness of those with whom you have interacted. And hence, if you see yourself doing in that panorama something mean to someone else or a hostile act, unkind act, then when that action has its consequence, you are in the consciousness of that person, and you feel directly and empathically the hurt that you've brought about in that person's life. Or, on the other hand, if you see yourself doing a kind-hearted and loving action to another human being, then you feel the good feelings that you brought about. One interesting thing, again, I hear universally from people about this being of compassion that reviews this life with them, is that they say what this person is interested in is not what we might imagine. It's not whether we were the football champion or not how many degrees we had or not power we might have had, none of those things. But rather, people universally report that what this person is interested in is one thing, and that is, they say there aren't any words, but insofar as you could say that he puts a question to you, and I say he because very often people do describe it as a male present, as you hear many times, like a male person. People say what this individual is interested in is put in the words, how have you learned to love? And they say really no words are needed because you see it in action there. Because if you see yourself doing something mean to someone else, then you just get the feelings back immediately. But if you see yourself doing a loving action to somebody else, then you feel the good feelings. Now, if we could halt right there for just a moment and bracket this and think about this, whatever you may think the causation of these experiences or what they may mean, if you think about it for a moment, it seems to me that as a very minimum, what we can say that the implication of this is that life is a two-phase process. And in the first phase of life, we live the action forward as the actor or protagonist. But in the second phase of life, we look at the same action from the point of view of the other people in the drama or the scene. So it's two phases. You look at life going this way, and then you look at it back from the other way from the perspective of other people. And that, to me, is a sobering thought when I think of some of the things I've done to people, you know? I mean, and not out of any overt meanness, but, you know, you fly off the handle and stuff. Another interesting thing about this is that people say that because language is sequential, then when you talk about this, you have to relate it as though it were a sequence. But in the experiencing of it, it's not a sequence, but rather everything is there at once, which means, in effect, that time dissolves. Time is not a factor in these experiences. And people say that when you enter into this other state of existence, that time just ceases to exist. And also space as we know it. People say, for example, movement isn't a totally different thing. You just sort of think about where you want to go and then you're there, with no sense of spatial transition in between. Now, obviously all of the people I've talked with anyway have had to make a return trip. Some people say that they have no idea how they got back. That they just, one moment they were in this light, the next moment they were back in the hospital room with no sense of a transition. Other people tell us that they were told they had to go back, like given an order. You've got to go back, they're told. You've got things you have left to do. But they're not told what they have to do, just that there are things left to do. And this can be very frustrating for people. Having had the privilege of knowing a number of people who've had that happen to them over the years, it's been very interesting to me that in the passage of time, they did realize. They say, oh, I didn't know what they meant by you got to go back, you've got things left to do. But as time passed, I realized what it was that I had left to do. Then a third group of people tell us that they were given a choice, that they could either go back to the life they had been leading, or they could continue with the experience. And again, not a bit surprising if you think about it. The ones I've talked with chose to come back. But what is interesting is that it is always basically for the same reason, although there are variations of it. It's always for someone else. They say, for myself, I would rather have stayed. but I chose to come back to continue my helping profession, is what some people say. Or most commonly people say, I chose to come back because I had young children left to raise. And that's the most common reason. And when they get back, that's where it really gets interesting from the point of view of a psychiatrist. Because, you know, both in my own life and also in my psychiatry practice, one thing I have observed about people is that most people are chasing something. In my case, I have spent pretty much my entire life chasing knowledge. Some people chase power. Some people chase fame or chase money. But whatever they are chasing, they say when they come out of this experience, they realize that all of that is kind of illusory and that what this is all about is learning to love. But here is a difficulty immediately. They say, this experience doesn't make that any easier. George Ritchie told me one time, and I guess, as I said, the finest man I ever knew. And George told me in 1976, he said, Raymond, this experience makes your humanity even more of a burden in a way. And the way I like to formulate this is, George would have never said anything like this, as you know who've met him. He was just a really wonderfully kind man, but the way I could translate that roughly is that in reality, it's very difficult to get through the average day without wanting to choke at least one person. And that human situation does not change just because you realize that this is all about love. George used to get up at 4 a.m. every morning to pray and meditate before he would start his work with his patients. So that's one major after effect. People tell us that when they come back from this, they realize that what this is really all about is love. And secondly, that they have absolutely no more fear of death. And I've seen this in action for so many decades now. I've had the privilege of being with some of these people that I would meet because of their near-death experience, and then maybe 20 years later, they would develop a terminal illness and I would be there with them right to the end. And the equanimity is just wonderful. You know, it's the George Ritchie, someone told me that just in the last day or so before he died, George said, well, I guess they're going to keep me permanently this time. So, no more fear of death. Now, this much that I've told, I'm sure you've all heard many times before. This is a classical statement of the near-death experiences. There are other elements, but the other elements typically occur in the extreme cases of people with extraordinarily lengthy cardiac arrest. People see other things, like cities of light is something I've heard. An entire civilization that is constructed of loving light. Or they see institutions of higher learning, is one I hear often. People with extremely lengthy cardiac arrest will tell you that they become aware of an entire level or dimension of existence in which people are occupied with the pursuit of knowledge. I used to think, wow, I can't wait to get there. Something George Ritchie told me years ago really haunts me about that. What he said was that when he saw into this institution of higher learning, he said if you could try to get some picture of it, even if you squeeze together in your mind MIT and Caltech and Yale and Harvard and Princeton, all the great universities, BYU, and all of them, because I've been there and I know that's a great place. Squeeze them all together, you couldn't even get the beginning of a conception of what this place is like. But George said this thing that's really troubling to me because I do love the pursuit of knowledge. George said that when he was with the Christ looking into this dimension of learning, and he saw these people going about their business of learning, he said that Christ was very proud of these people But George said, they couldn't see him. And I think that's troubling to me in a way. And what it indicates, I think, is that, you know, knowledge is important. And people will tell you that when they see this review of their life and their scenes emerge in which they've been learning something, that this is brought to their attention is a good thing. And the thought that comes to them is, even after you die, this process of learning goes on. So I don't know exactly what that's all about, but it's, I guess, wise to be careful about inferring what that means. It's just Nietzsche said one time, the opposite of love is not hate, but the dispassionate pursuit of truth. And that's, you know, I've seen cases like that too, where people get so preoccupied with the pursuit of some knowledge that they sort of lose their soul. I guess that's the Faust story, isn't it? The story of Faust. Now, this much we've all heard before, but in 1972, I was a first-year medical student at the Medical College of Georgia. Along about Christmas time, at the end of my first quarter at the medical college, I was in the bookstore, and a woman walked in who I had not met before. She knew who I was because the faculty got a book of photographs of the incoming students so they could know who everybody was. And so this very nice woman walked up and introduced herself as Dr. So-and-so. And I immediately recognized the name as a very distinguished professor of medicine at my medical college. And she said, Dr. Moody, I've been wanting to meet you because I have an experience I wanted to tell you about. And she took me across the campus to her office. And what she said was that a year or so before, she had had the sad duty of having to try to resuscitate her mother, who actually did go on and die. The resuscitation didn't work. But there she was, and her mother had an unanticipated cardiac arrest right in front of her. And so she had the duty of trying to resuscitate her mother. And she said, when her mother died, she felt or sensed that her mother had died. She herself, this physician, got out of her own body and rose up. And I should also mention to you that, like me, she had not been raised in a religious context and really had no inkling of an idea of an afterlife. But she said, there she was looking at her own body down below, trying to resuscitate her mother, seeing her own mother's now deceased body in the bed. And to use her exact words, because I wrote them down that day, she said, I was trying to get my bearings. And as she looked around, she said she saw her mother there, again to use her exact words, now in spirit form. And she said her goodbye to her mother, and she saw her mother recede toward this very powerful light that seemed to be coming out of a tube. And she said, emerging from that light, she saw people, some of whom she recognized, and they were relatives and friends of her mother's who had died after this physician was born. And she saw some other people there. She had no idea who they were, except she just surmised that they must be people who her mother had known before she was born. And she saw this very tender reunion with her mother and all these people. And then she said it was like they were magnetized back into this light. And the detail that really stands out most from this experience to this day to me, she said that when this light closed off, it did so in a spiral fashion, going down like that, like the lens of a camera. She said, you know how it closes in a spiral. And at that point, she found herself back in her body and her mother deceased in the bed. And that was the first case I had heard of what I have come to call shared death experiences. Here, you see the identically the same phenomena unfold, except that they occur not to somebody who almost dies and is brought back, but rather to somebody who is standing there or attending the dying. And a very interesting thing happened from the 70s on into the early 80s. I heard a lot of these, but almost invariably I heard them from physicians. And the typical thing I would hear was that physicians would tell me that as the patient died, they would see what in some cases was described as like a transparent replica of the person would kind of stand up and move away from the body and move away. Or in other cases, they say it was like a light, not a diffuse, even light, but rather the way this is described is they say it's often kind of roundish, but that it has a very complex structure in it. And this is often described as grayish or golden light. And the typical thing is that this light just moves up and away from the body and in many cases sort of disappears through the ceiling. Or physicians would tell me things like that the light in the room changed when a patient died. And so, as I said, through the early 80s, I was hearing most of these from physicians. But then sometime in the mid-80s, I guess, and then certainly on into the 90s, I began to hear more and more of these from bystanders, relatives or friends of people who died. And I sort of sensed immediately what this was all about. For those of you who are old enough to remember this, in 1972, when I entered medical school, the standard hospital practice was that when we recognized that a patient was dying, the doctors and nurses would come and escort the family out. And the theory was that, you know, this is just too overwhelming for the patient's family, so we will spare them this. And the doctors and nurses were there attending the dying. But gradually this has changed to where now in 2011 it's the exact opposite. Physicians and nurses tend to encourage the family to be there to the end. And unless the doctors and nurses have some particular bond with that family, they will tend to make themselves scarce, so it can be a family situation. Concurrently with that change in the hospital practice, I saw the shift of this so that I was hearing more and more of these shared death experiences from family members and relatives and friends at the bedside. You know, one thing that has baffled me about this for many years, since I guess the late 80s, when people would come to interview me, as they often do for shows, TV things and so on, I would bring this up. I say, oh yeah, in addition to the experiences of people who almost died, this same thing happens to the bystanders. And it's very interesting that that was always edited out. And I used to be very curious about this. I've written about this in various of my books at least now for 14 or so years. And yet it never gets picked up. And I've done a lot of reflection on why that is. And the real answer is I don't know. But I have wondered whether it might be that that's hitting too close to home. I think many of us may have a hard time imagining that we might be in a situation of almost dying. And so for that reason, the near-death experience is a little more interesting because we can have a certain distance from it. Oh, that wasn't me. That was somebody else who almost died. But if it's prospect of being there with a loved one who dies, well, we can imagine that a lot easier. And it may just be that the reason why this was not picked up so much until recently is that it's less comfortable to people than the idea of someone else almost dying and coming back. But the idea that I might be there at the bedside and experience something is a little more uncomfortable to people. And in 1994, I was getting ready to publish all this. On Mother's Day of 1994, I was out in Las Vegas getting ready to study this with some other psychologists and psychiatrists and so on. It's kind of setting up some systematic way of studying this phenomenon. On Sunday, when we finished our meeting, I went to the local shopping mall and used an antique instrument, which the younger ones here will not know of, but the older ones might remember, a payphone, right? And so I called my mom in Macon, Georgia, and it was a very upbeat conversation. I said, you know, how are you doing? And I remember the chipperness in her voice. She said, oh, I'm doing great. It was just very enthusiastic. And then she just mentioned casually that the day before she had developed a rash, and my brothers and sisters, as a precaution, had taken her down to the emergency room. But the doctor looked her over and said he thought it was just insignificant. But as a precaution, he gave my mother a doctor's appointment the following Monday, and which was the day after I talked to her. So on Sunday, the perception was that everything was fine. Mom had a rash, maybe an allergy or something. And then the next day when she went to the doctor told her, you have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and you have 2 days to 2 weeks to live. So my wife and I went to Macon, Georgia, and we were there beside my mother's bed the whole 2 weeks. And indeed, 2 weeks after the diagnosis, she died. At that point, she had been in a coma for 2 days. But as she was dying, my wife and my sister and my brother-in-law and I all had one of these shared death experiences. And here I am, just like Jeff, I don't have the words. But the best I can describe this to you is I would say that the room changed configuration. You know, a hospital room is like a box-like structure. Suddenly, it was like the space in the room became into a funnel shape. That's the best I can describe it. And I know full well upon reviewing that, I was intensely focused on my mother. But subsequently, I've realized that if I had just done a little intrapsychic move, and instead of focusing like this, I would have just done more of this sort of thing. I feel certain I would have been out of my body. I've never had an out-of-body experience, but I think that was the closest. And the light just filling up the room. My wife experiencing the same thing, and my sister experiencing the spirit of my father who had died 18 months before. And what happened to me at that point was that I lost my motivation to write about this. Because what drives me in my writing is curiosity. And so I just let this slide. I continued to collect cases, but I just sort of lost interest in writing about it because I knew from internally what it was like. And then about 2 years ago, Guideposts approached me with the possibility of writing this up. So I did. They asked me to mention that this new book is called Glimpses of Eternity, and it's descriptions of some of the shared death experiences that I've heard from people over the years. As I mentioned to you, all of the common features of a near-death experience also regularly occur to bystanders at the bedside of the dying. Up to and including, by the way, the panoramic life review. What could be more exotic and extraordinary that a person standing there at the bedside would empathically co-live the life review of someone who dies? And yet, it's much more common than you might imagine. For example, let's just show, like as I look around in here, if you don't mind, how, in terms of this shared death experience, how many of you know from your own personal experience what I'm talking about? If you could just hold up your hand a minute. And I'm seeing a lot of hands there. If you just look around the room at those hands, just in a group this size, we have a lot of people who've experienced this. How does this proceed? Well, again, as I mentioned, one of the common things people say is that as the point of death, they actually see something exit the body. Or some people tell us that when their loved one died, that they themselves got out of their body and rose up and accompanied their dying loved one partway toward this light. Sometimes I hear, it's through a mist, as a lady was telling me earlier tonight, I hear this too, they say it's like you see a mist or a field where you can't get a clear vision in front of you, and then through that, this light begins to emerge. Or people will say that the room is suddenly flooded with light. And again, as many people will say, like I did, that the room seems to change configuration, that you're no longer in a three-dimensional space, but in some hyper-dimensional space that you just don't have the vocabulary to describe. People hear music. This is a very common thing. It's a case in North Carolina. Man was telling me that he was sitting there at the bedside and he asked his sister, like, "Do you hear that music?" And she didn't, but that he heard this heavenly music coming through as his mother, I think it was dying. Or people will say that sometimes they talk about this tunnel. Just recently, I received a communication from a man who said twice during when loved ones of his died that he saw this tunnel open, and that one time he actually went through that tunnel, and on the other side of it, he was able to be there with some of his relatives who had died some years before. And again, all of these people are not ill or injured. They just happen to be there when someone else dies. And most remarkably of all, as I said, cases in which the bystander actually empathically co-lives the life review of the person who passes away. And to me, this is just beyond amazing. I have a lot of cases of this. And again, to sort of illustrate this, does anybody here know about this that I'm talking about from your personal experience? Yeah, one, two, and three, I see, and four, and five, and I don't know how many other hands I see others. There's at least about six or seven that I can see up in these first few rows. Now, why don't we know about that? To me, that's an amazing fact that bystanders sometimes feel that they empathically co-live the life review of someone who dies. The one that is most memorable to me is a wonderful woman I knew in Carrollton, Georgia, 20 plus years ago. I was a professor of psychology there, and this elderly woman with a wonderful mole on her cheek right here. I remember to this down this cheek. Just a very delightful lady. She had one of these marriages which are so firm and strong between them. You know, we all know that the Greeks had the three types of love, right? The agape and the eros and the philos and so on. But what's not so widely known, for some reason I don't understand, but the Greeks also recognized a fourth category of love. And in fact, this is of great clinical relevance if you are a grief counselor, like I spend a lot of time doing. And that was called sturge love. And the Greeks had noticed that in these outlying farms and so on, there was a recurrent pattern whereby two kids from adjoining farms, a boy and a girl, who just grew up together playing in the, you know, just running around the farm, that it was a natural progression that over the years this friendship would just develop into a marriage. I know I had two aunts and two uncles. They'd grown up together on the adjacent farms and played together as kids, and then they just developed into this marriage. And my Aunt Dwight, I remember, when Clifford died, her childhood playmate, she had known literally since childhood, and they had this long, long, decades-long marriage. And when Clifford died, Aunt Dwight just never got over it. You know, every time you would see her, she'd just melt into tears. And that was the first experience I had of the strength of this sturge love. This woman that I'm talking about in Carrollton, Georgia, had this kind of love with her husband. They had literally been childhood playmates in this little town. And they had grown up together, and in high school, they decided to get married. And in the intervening months before the summer that they graduated, she found she was pregnant. And believe me, in Georgia at that period of time, that was a major scandal. And so they took it very nicely, but they were looking forward to the baby, and they kept just sort of thinking, well, how are we going to tell our parents about this and so on? But in this process, she had a spontaneous miscarriage, and they lost the child. So they never did talk about it with anybody else except their local country doctor helped them through this. She said throughout their marriage, they never had another child. She never again got pregnant. throughout their marriage, they always talked about their child they had lost as though it had been a boy. They would say, well, now he would be 6 years old, now he would be in high school, and so on. And then, after decades of marriage, her husband was found to have a very severe and fast-growing lung cancer, and she was with him in the hospital the last few days of his life constantly. And she said, as he was dying, this panorama of everything he had ever done sprang up around them. And she said, they were there in the presence of Christ. And she said, she was talking with her husband about these different scenes, that as she would say, oh, look over there, that's when we did such and such. And he would agree, and they would go back and forth like this. And a very interesting detail of this, she said that she saw all the things her husband had done, many of which she had been involved with, but there were other things that she didn't know that came up in his review that she had not known. But in addition, there were some areas of this that were blocked off by, I think the word she used was like screens or panels that had come down, and there was some of her husband's life that she couldn't see. And when she was kind of curious about this and not feeling so good about it, she said this being of complete compassion sort of conveyed to her, oh, that's not anything bad, and the fullness of time you will see that too. It's just that for now it's not the right time for you to see that. She said out of the area of this panorama that had to do with the death of their child, she said this little light emerged and came forward and came together with her husband and her. And this person identified herself as their daughter, not their son, as they had always thought, but a daughter. And she said it was very inspiring to her to actually to see that her daughter and her husband got together, and it gave her a great deal of comfort that when he died, he just passed away and was with their daughter. Now, what do you make of that? It's really gotten to the point, I think, with this, where the so-called skeptical objections that, oh, this is the physiology of the brain and so on, that is just so retro now. I think it's, for one thing, these people who make that kind of objection, in my experience, have never really taken the trouble to go and actually talk with actual people who've been through this. They're just kind of armchair speculating. But the more annoying part of this, you see, to me, I love to teach ancient Greek philosophy. And the reason why these pseudo-skeptics, as I call them, annoy me so much has to do with that. Because let me explain to you what a skeptic really is. Okay? The skeptical movement of philosophy arose in the wake of Aristotle. And as probably all of you know, Aristotle was the person who codified the logic that we're using to think right now. That it was so spectacularly successful system that it seeped out into the regular channels of communication as well. And it's still the hallmark of logic in the academic and scientific disciplines, but it's also the same system of thinking that we use in our ordinary life. So what we can say about this logic is that Aristotle really taught us a set of procedures by which we can draw conclusions. And in the wake of that, the skeptical philosophy arose, and the person who invented this was named Pyrrho. And Pyrrho's thought was, well, we know how to draw conclusions now, but what if we don't draw the conclusion? That's what a skeptic means if you look at it. It's easy information to access. The point of this was that they even had manuals to tell you how not to draw a conclusion. Don't draw a conclusion that there's a podium there. It might be a holographic projection or a cardboard cutout, or I might be dreaming or whatever. But it wasn't just cantankerousness that made them do this. It was that by assiduously practicing this, what they happened to them was that, number one, they would have a mind-expanding experience. And this really does work. I mean, I'm kind of the habitual skeptic myself, and it does a very interesting thing to your mind. And perhaps more importantly, if you think about it geometrically, if everybody else is rushing in this direction to get to the conclusion, but your process is to avoid drawing a conclusion, then if you think about it, what that does is that makes you attend or pay attention to the periphery, right? If everybody else is running in this direction, but you're looking over here, you may see side pathways of inquiry that everybody else had missed because they're focused in this direction to get to the conclusion. And that's the value of being a skeptic. Now, knowing that, let's run back what the so-called skeptics tell us. It's like, I'm a skeptic about these near-death experiences. I think it's just the chemistry of the brain. Well, now let's unpack that remark and see what it means. It is, I'm a person who doesn't draw conclusions, and my conclusion is such and such. So the people who propound this doctrine that presents itself as skepticism don't even have the skeptical talent required to look up the word and see what it means. So that's what's so annoying about that group to me. I think that we're really in a situation now where we have to do two things, and both of them go back to Plato. I want to say this. To me, the question of life after death is the most important question of existence. That is the really big question when it gets right down to it. And how one is going to address that question or try to settle it for yourself is really, more than anything else, it's a philosophical choice. And historically, there have been three ways that people have done it. Some people say, I'm satisfied that there's an afterlife because of my religious faith. That's enough for me. And I want to say, I honor that. If somebody comes and says, I'm convinced that there's an afterlife because of my religious faith, I say, great. And let's set that aside for a moment as unquestioned. That's fine. Then there's another group of people who say, well, I'm convinced that there's an afterlife because I had this experience. I almost died. I got into my body and went through a tunnel and saw a light and so on. And I say, I honor that, and that's unquestioned. And bow to those people and say, yes, that's wonderful. And then let's sort of set that aside. But then there still is a group of people who don't have faith, but they don't have an experience either. What is left for those people? And historically, the third path has been reason. And the question is, can we prove life after death by some sort of rational argument? And really, one thing about this field, there are people whose specialty is inquiring into the afterlife, the parapsychologist and so on. But I think that that field is based on a really false assumption, like an inadequate assumption, and that is that science can solve this problem. I don't think that the life after death is a scientific question, at least not yet, not in 2011. It may be in the future. But still, that leaves reason. Is there a rational pathway? And Plato made this observation, which I think has not been adequately addressed by the parapsychologists and so on, but it's a good observation. Plato said that if we are genuinely interested in seeing whether reason can solve this question for us, he said there are always two elements. He said, one, you've got to have some sort of storyline just to get discussion started, because the notion is not so clear of an afterlife. So you've got to have some sort of story. And in our society, it's near-death experiences, right? I got out of my body, I went through the tunnel. The ancient Greek philosophers debated about these near-death experiences in identically the same terms that people do today. It was cast between the believers like Plato, who had accepted it at face value, and on the other hand, the people like Democritus, the founder of atomic theory, who said, oh, this is just the brain winding down, and there's no such thing as a moment of death, and these are hallucinations, although that would not have been the word he used, but the same idea. So there's always got to be some storyline, but also Plato said that there's got to be some set of concepts that enable us to prove. We've got to have some sort of logical system or whatever that makes it before we can have a proof. And that is where the real difficulty began. Those of you who might know who David Hume was, he was a friend of Ben Franklin's, to date him for you. He died at the time of our American Revolution in 1776. And Hume was a very brilliant propounder of some fundamental notions relating to the scientific method. He talked about causation, for example, and inductive reasoning, which scientists use. And Hume commented this on the afterlife, and I think this is one of the wisest and most incisive statements that any scholar has ever made about the problem. And I think if you think it through for yourself, you'll see what Hume was getting at. He said, "By the mere light of reason, it seems difficult to prove the immortality of the soul." And he went on to say, "Some new species of logic is required for that purpose, and some new faculties of the mind, that they may enable us to comprehend that logic." And that is the real problem, no matter what anybody wants to say about it. If you are really committed to looking at this question from a rational point of view, that is what you face. I talk all the time. I love to talk to people who don't put any credence to the afterlife. And I've done this since the late 60s and early 70s. I love to talk with people who say, "Absolutely not, there's not an afterlife." And I said, "Well, how did you come to that?" And I can tell you just from experience what most people say is, now sometimes you'll have people who are just kind of against it on general principles because maybe they had a tough religious upbringing or something and they had rejected it cynically. But I'm talking, rather than that, I'm talking about the people who really think it through. And they all come up with exactly what Hume said. They said, "It's illogical. What do you mean, a life after death? If you look up the words in the dictionary, death just means the final irreversible cessation of life." So you're saying, there is life after the final irreversible cessation of life. It doesn't make sense. And that is the real difficulty. But, you know, people look at Hume's remark as a downer, but I say, no, that's the real challenge. What I would just go on and say right now with great confidence is that Hume's problem has now been solved. And that is why I say that I am confident in predicting that 5 years down the road, this whole field of near-death studies is going to be totally different from what it is now. Because the essential problems that hold back the rational inquiry into this field have now, in my opinion, been solved. And it's not that I think that exactly. It's I've done some work on this, and I put it out to 14 of the toughest, meanest, smartest scholars I know, none of whom had any interest in an afterlife. And I asked them to look at my work, and I said, "Try to find any defect or error in my reasoning, because before you publish a book, you want to know all the objections in advance." And so the fact that my colleagues have said, "Yeah, this is valid," gives me confidence that I'm on the right wavelength here. Now, what this means is that we now have new methods of rational study of the afterlife, which is going to solve, I'm confidently predicting here, it's going to solve the ineffability problem. What we can now do is to reformat people's minds by taking them through a process of education which enables them to talk in an entirely new way about things that have been beyond the realm of logical expression up to now. And when people who have been through this procedure in the future have near-death experiences, they will have a language with which to talk about it. But the really good thing that comes out of this is that, remember Hume said, in terms of the proof of an afterlife, some new species of logic is required for that purpose and some new faculties of the mind that they may enable us to comprehend that logic. And that is what we have now. is entirely possible to open entirely new unknown channels of the mind. It's actually fairly easy, really, and enable us, I think, to look into this in an entirely new way. I can guarantee, standing here, 5 years, 6 years down the road, there will still be research into near-death experiences and so on, but it will be based on entirely new rational principles. I'm predicting that, and I feel very confident in predicting it. Now, great, thank you. Now, I do want to close here with one little remark, and that is that I wouldn't want you folks to think that all of this is always so all-fired serious. Like, I was talking, like, here a little while back with this man, and he was telling me about his near-death experience. He was saying he was in his doctor's office, and suddenly he had a cardiac arrest, and he said he went up out of his body, and he went through this tunnel. He came out into this beautiful place like a meadow with greenery all around. And he said when he came into this meadow, he was lying flat on his back, kind of feeling like he was going to pass out, when all of a sudden, a great big white bunny came hopping up, but standing up like a man. And he said the big bunny had on bright polka dot clothes like a clown would wear, and a big bright blue stethoscope around his neck like a clown would wear. And he said he was lying there, and suddenly the big bunny came real close down to him over his face like that, and one time went like that, like blew him in the face. And the man said when the big bunny did that, he felt himself whirling back through this tunnel, and there he was lying on the examining table in his doctor's office. And he said, he told the doctor what had happened, and he said, the doctor looked at him and said, well, you know, there may be something to it, because you did come to just within a hair's breadth of dying. Now that one I just made up. I just want to close this off by saying again, thank you. It's always wonderful to be out here with you. I have such many wonderful memories of Salt Lake, and I remember first time I came out here was in 1978. I lectured at the Marriott Center at BYU, and you know how the Mormons have this wonderful record-keeping ability, and they, a few weeks after I came, they had this wonderful letter, and they said there were 10,000... so several hundred and something people at that lecture, and I just thought, you know, they actually took account of it. And what I remember from that is that 10,000 smiling faces. And after my lecture, young people came up with their Xeroxed family records, you know, some of them well over 100 years old, where they had I know that the Latter-day Saints folks have over the years made a practice of recording these experiences. And I thought that was just wonderful that this tradition was carried on so long. And so it's always wonderful to be here. Many times before I've been out here, and I've always expressed that opinion of being don't know. But here I am in the situation where I really do now. I've run out of options. It's like, what do you say looking at all this stuff? And there's no plausible alternate scenario. I don't know what else to say, but looking at all this, what strikes me is that, my goodness, there really is a life after death. And it really makes this world kind of baffling, doesn't it? You know, I mean, if there's a life after death, then what are we doing here? That's what I'm trying to figure out now. But thank you all so much.